Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. And I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 151. I'm recording it on Thursday, July 23rd, 2009. The PE 10 level today is 16. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. Who's that? Who did that? Did you hear that music? Well, that's unacceptable. The music for the podcast, maybe Kevin jumped in because I was mentioning his name. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at the Incompetech.com site. And the title for this selection is Matt's Blues. The title of the podcast is The History of Investing, According to Old Farmer Hocus. I had to spice up the title. It sounded bland to just call it The History of Investing. I try to have a little spice in my titles. And the Old Farmer Hocus thing, I sometimes mention that. It's a weird thing. I'll be talking about something. I'll say, Old Farmer Hocus says it. The background of that is a post I wrote, God knows how many years ago now. But there was a guy, Cute Fuzzy Bunny. He was one of the goon posters at the early retirement forum. And he thought he was the center of the world. And, he was going to stomp me out of existence because I had told the truth about safe withdrawal rates. And I don't recall what he put up, something that was just particularly egregious. I don't recall at all what it was. But one day it just prompted me to do a blog entry called The Terrible Truth About Cute Fuzzy Bunny. And it was very funny. And I have sort of three types of blog entries, or podcast or whatever post. One is the hard stuff where I'll talk about numbers, and people seem to love that stuff. And then there's the sort of stuff that focuses on the emotional side of investing, and that's the stuff that I think is most important, but people definitely don't take to it as well. They're more used to the numbers stuff. They think if you're talking about investing, it has to be numbers. And I think the numbers stuff has great value. I'm not trying to say otherwise. I personally think the emotional stuff is really where it's at. But people tend to like the numbers more. But a third type are just these humor posts. And every now and then I'll just get a little riff. And those are really my favorites. I don't think they're the most important, but I just like them. And I think possibly the funniest one I did a couple of them that were funny. One was The Terrible Truth About Cute Fuzzy Bunny. That was very funny. And that's where Old Farmer Hocus came from. Farmer Hocus was out in his field, and Cute Fuzzy Bunny was, this abusive poster, and Farmer Hocus was throwing pebbles at him or whatever. And but there was one I did. There was one I did I thought was very funny. It was a John Graney did some kind of review of my book, it was a smear review, and I took quotes out, how they do in movie reviews. Somebody will say, the worst experience, you won't believe it. This is the worst experience you'll ever have in a movie theater. And they'll just quote, you won't believe it, an experience, And I took his review, which was a smear review, and I took out quotes and was like, yeah, you've got to read it, extraordinary, and all this stuff. That was funny, and there was a couple like that anyway. But just sharing that's part of the history of stock investing, the campaign of terror against the retire early and indexing discussion boards. That's part of the history. It's a footnote to the history of investing. Anyways, I think it would be helpful to have a history, because all that's going on in investing today, it's very strange, and it's taken me a long time to come to understand. I don't understand it all today, but I understand it a whole lot better today than I did on the morning of May 13th, 2002, that's for sure. And now that we are in an economic crisis, I believe that there are more people developing an interest in solving the problems. And the problems, according to old Farmer Hocus, all relate back to passive investing. That's the root of it, all of the troubles we've had. Not everybody says that. There's one or two that have a different theory. Something about the bankers did it to us, all this sort of thing. Well, the bankers didn't help, but the bankers were making the same mistakes that everybody else was making. They were using those same economic models that produced the passive investing school of investing for middle-class investors, and they just did the same dumb stuff we did. They miscalculated risk, just like we did. So the real problem is not the bankers, and it's not us. It's this dumb idea that you can just take the price that that stocks are selling for, or houses, and just say, oh, that's the right price, just because somehow this mystical market said it, that makes it right. That's what passive investing is all about. It's all about something called the efficient market theory, and it says whatever price the market comes to must be right. It's the market, must be right. And it's not. The price of stocks was three times fair value at the height of the bull. So the market wasn't efficient at all. It was wildly inefficient. And it was wildly inefficient from 1996 through September of 2008. So much for the efficient market theory, so much for passive investing. And the bankers didn't do it. The bankers were using more complicated versions of the same jibber-jabber. They made all the same dumb mistakes that all middle-class investors made, and, you know, they just made them on a bigger scale. But it all is rooted in this stupid idea that was developed by very smart people. That's why I want to tell the history. But a stupid idea, just because you're smart doesn't mean you can't come up with a stupid idea. So, you know, we're humans, we're flawed. So, but I think it helps, the whole thing is hard for people to believe. I talk about it, and the reaction you get, and this is even true, you know, friends of mine, you know, they just hear it, and it just can't be true. This is just too bizarre that all these smart people are following this dumb approach, and on their money, they're putting their money at risk, and it doesn't make any sense. That can't be right, Rob. Well, sorry. But that's it. What people do is they start believing passive investing is right, and they squeeze all the facts into that package. And if the facts don't fit, they just chop them off. But the problem, so no evidence can ever persuade a passive investor that he's wrong. But, you know, you can lose 50% of your money, it doesn't persuade you, because you're like, well, must have been the bankers. I don't know. I don't know what happened. I lost all my money. Something happened, but I guess it was bankers, because passive investing can't be wrong. It can never be passive investing. You see, it's never worked. We've got historical data going back to 1870. Passive investing's never, in the history of the United States, ever worked for the long term. It's often worked for the short term. Never for the long term. But they can't admit it. But people can't believe that. They just say, that just doesn't ring true. If you understand the history, it makes a little more sense. You can at least, I mean, it doesn't make a great deal of sense, but it makes a little more. You can start to put it into historical perspective. That helps. So I want to do a podcast called The History of Investing, and to jazz up the title, I add it, according to old Farmer Hocus, throwing pebbles at cute fuzzy bunny. All right. The first part, you know, there was a famous New Yorker cartoon where somebody drew a map of the United States, and it was like, you know, Manhattan blown up real big, and then it was like a little arrow with, you know, the rest of the United States over here. That's sort of how I'm going to tell this history. I'm going to start in 1960. The first chapter of the history is pre-1960, and I'm just throwing that all into a bundle, because the purpose of this exercise is to explain how passive investing got us so messed up. And the pre-1960 stuff doesn't really matter too much. So I'm just throwing that. I'm sure that you could write 1,000 pages of history on that period if you were an historian. But I'm just throwing it all into one one chapter, and that's pre-1960. I don't know what you want to call it. You could call it the pre-passive investing era, or you could call it the pre-Bogle era, the pre-indexing era. You could call it the pre-middle class era, because a big change, all these changes that happened at the same time, roughly. You know, Bogle got involved, indexing got involved, academics got involved, middle class increased its need to invest for retirement. All these things happened beginning in 1960 and then escalated in the later decades. But before that, none of these things applied. So investing was just a different world pre-1960 in old Farmer Hokus's view. It was a different world. And the idea of investing in those days, there are lots of great books. Lots of the old books on investing are fantastic. And all of these same controversies applied. Rational investing was around going back, you know, what's his name? Benjamin Graham. Benjamin Graham wrote the Bible of stock investing, Security Analysis. Benjamin Graham was Warren Buffett's mentor. And Benjamin Graham recommended valuation-informed indexing in his book, Security Analysis, way back in the 1930s. That gives you some idea. These ideas of none of these ideas discussed at my website or among the passive investors are new. People just put a new spin on them. We go through these cycles and ideas become, you know, one side becomes popular, rational becomes popular, and then for some reason, people decide to go emotional. Things happen in the world that make investors want to become emotional. And then, you know, for marketing reasons, the emotional approach becomes the most popular. And because the emotional approach cannot stand scrutiny, it becomes socially taboo to mention its deficiencies. And so then it really becomes popular because nobody can hear the other side. And then it causes an economic collapse, and then rational comes back in, and it cycles. But but it always changes a little bit. You know, they say history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Benjamin Graham recommended valuation-informed indexing. He said, at times of low valuations, put 75% in stocks. At times of moderate valuations, 50%. At times of high valuations, 25%. That's essentially valuation-informed indexing. The difference is, when Benjamin Graham recommended it in the early 1930s, index funds were not available. So he was really recommending valuation-informed investing rather than valuation-informed indexing. But indexes make that strategy 10 times more powerful. Because in order to do it the Benjamin Graham way, you had to pick stocks. And that's a lot of work. And the average middle-class investor doesn't have the time or inclination to do that effectively. Today, it's easy as pie to follow Benjamin Graham's recommendation. That's what makes it so powerful in my mind. But I would characterize the pre-60 period as probably, if I had to characterize it and put a name to it, I would call it the buy low, sell high era. You know, you can't, it's not fair to characterize, you know, all those years under one title. But if I had to do it, that's what I would do. And basically the idea was, you know, common sense, you want to buy low. As strange as it is, that's what has been challenged by the passive investors. You know, as strange as can be, but that's the challenge. That's what they were trying to tear down. And that's what's caused all the trouble, because buy low, sell high is the most common sense idea in the world. Everybody who buys stocks has bought other things. We've all bought houses or cars or comic books or bananas. And we all know from long experience that when it comes to cars and houses and comic books and bananas, price matters. Excuse me. So the natural thing to do is to say, well, stocks, same thing, price matters. But that's not what we do, is it? That's not what we do. Not if we're passive investors. We don't change our allocation when price changes, do we? So why it's such a disaster? That's how we got into so much trouble. But in the pre-Bogle, pre-indexing, pre-whatever era, the general thought was the thing to do was buy low, sell high. Now, this is very, very, very important for what comes after. Buy low, let's just say buy low, sell high is common sense, and it is. If you buy, it doesn't matter whether you're buying an individual stock or an index. If you buy low and sell high, you're going to do well, right? You're gonna make money. Good thing. Now, as I say, this is pure common sense. It's insulting to you that I have to say it, but I have to say it because this passive investing stuff has been shoved down our throats for 30 years now. Buy low, sell high, and passive investing are opposites. Passive investing is buy at whatever. Buy low, buy medium, buy high, and sell at whatever. Because if you're a passive investor, you in theory, you never sell. But at some point, of course, you have to sell. I mean, if you never sell the stocks, they're not going to do you any good. You have to get money from them. So buy it, who knows what. You know, buy every time. Buy low, buy sell, buy high, buy medium. And sell whenever you happen to need to sell. You know, in other words, there's no plan. It's just, hold as long. Definitely, it's a long-term idea. You know, hold for many years. But then when you need the money, you know, cash it in for your retirement, whatever, as you need it. But you have no plan on what to buy and no plan on what price to sell at. You're just, it's random. It's just mindless. That's passive investing. That's the killer of middle class retirements. That's the cause of our economic crisis. But I'm trying to make a point here that this is there, you know, decades and centuries. I mean, you know, of experience with investing tells us the common sense thing to do is to buy low, sell high. And what changed beginning in 1960, it was just sort of a gleam in Eugene Fama's eye in 1960, but it's grown to be this monster in the intervening decades, was this idea, no, do not buy low, sell high. This idea came to be rejected. The common sense wisdom of hundreds of years came to be rejected by smart people. Eugene Fama is smart. John Bogle is smart. Burton Malkiel is smart. Smart people came to reject the most basic common sense idea imaginable. And that's where all the trouble begins. So that's why I only have one chapter on the before 1960, investing was more or less sane. Now, there were these insane time periods like the 20s, you know, that led to the Great Depression, just as the 90s are leading to what may be the second Great Depression. There were time periods when people forgot buy low, sell high, you know, and they just bought and bought and bought and bought and caused an economic crisis. So this isn't the first time it's happened, but it's never happened to this extent. It's never happened for, it's never become conventional wisdom. But basically, this idea came along, this thing called the efficient market. And that's the same thing. It's the intellectual justification for passive investing, the efficient market theory. And this idea has deep roots. This is why it's become so widespread. The efficient market theory is the idea that the market is always right. You know, if you reduce it to layman's language, that's what it says. It says you might think you're smart. You know, you might have studied investing for 50 years, and you think you're smart as the Dickens. Well, you're not, buddy. The market knows everything. The market is a super genius. You can't beat the market. And this is why you don't buy low, sell high. Forget that. We're going to come up with a dirty name for that. We're going to call it timing. And we're going to spend hundreds of million dollars repeating over and over again, timing doesn't work, timing doesn't work, timing doesn't work, because we hate that. We hate that. Because if you time, which means to look at price, which is, of course, the key to success in investing, if you do that, you are suggesting that there's some flaw in the market. And we are extremists. And we believe markets can never have a flaw. Markets are God. Markets are God. That's what the efficient market people believe. They don't say it that way, but boil away all the verbiage, and that's what it comes to. They think the market is God. Now, I love markets, but I don't think they're God. I believe God created humans, and so I sort of put humans ahead of the market. Controversial. I put humans ahead of the market. Although, of course, the full reality is the market is comprised of humans. But markets can do great things, as humans can, and markets can do bad things. Markets can be stupid. Markets can be smart. They have their smart side, as humans do, and they have their stupid side. And I say that the key to investing is to, excuse me again, is to look at the market and make an evaluation. Is it smart or is it stupid? And then invest accordingly. As Benjamin Graham said, when it's smart, you know, invest a good amount of money in it, and when it's stupid, you know, pull back, protect your portfolio. All right, so Eugene Fama came along. He loved markets. He created something called, he basically took, I think of it as Adam Smith's invisible hand idea, you know, which goes back classical economics. And he just said, well, I presume that he believed in that stuff. I don't know the history, but, and he said, I'm going to apply this to stock investing. Now, it's called a theory. So some people call it the efficient market hypothesis. So there certainly was never any scientific justification for this. This is what they'll claim. They'll say, oh, it's science. It's science. This is what they say today, or what they've said, you know, before the crash. But there was never, I mean, it's science in the sense that they put together lots of charts and numbers and all this sort of thing. But it's a hypothesis. Hypothesis isn't something, a finding. It's just a theory. It's something they floated. And a lot of people came to believe it, but it was never proven. It can't be proven. It's false. So it can't be proven. So they put forward this idea. Now, an important point here is, why did they, what possessed these people? Well, part of it is that, I think part of it is just that this idea that the market knows everything is a popular idea. As I say, it's classical economics. It's, you know, Adam Smith's invisible hand. It's a popular idea in the economic field in general. So all that Fama was doing, in my mind, was taking this popular idea in the intellectual community and sort of applying it to investing. It was a perfectly natural thing for somebody to do. But it, you know, because a lot of people were already primed to believe in markets, it took off. That's one reason. But there's a second reason, and this is so important. It sets up everything. So pay attention. As I understand it, and I'm not a historian, but just from things I've picked up, as I understand it, the efficient market hypothesis was intended to explain an unexpected phenomenon. And so if you understand why we got this efficient market theory, you'll understand how things got so off track. The unexplained, remember how I said the first stage of investing was buy low, sell high. People thought, The job of an investor is to know when the price is good and to buy, and when the price is bad and to sell. As I said, it's common sense. It's how we do everything. It's how we buy everything. But there were studies that showed that doesn't work. And the efficient market theory, as I understand things, was intended to explain that phenomenon. In other words, they said, wait a minute. What they did was they said, well, here, pick a stock, you know, pick a price you think is good, and then we'll check 6 months later, and we'll see whether, you know, you did a good job or not. We'll study it scientifically. And they found no. The people that picked, you know, sometimes they got it right, sometimes they got it wrong. They didn't do any better than just random picks. You know, this old saying, you could throw monkeys could throw at a dartboard. You do just as good as these experts picking stocks. And people said, well, why is that? That's unexpected. We thought the idea is buy low, sell high. Doesn't look like it is. What's going on here? And what's our explanation? This is why they came up with this so-called hypothesis to explain it. They said, well, maybe, I think they said maybe at the time, but they forgot the maybe a little later on. They said, well, maybe what's going on is, let's just say, could it be that the market's efficient? Could it be that the market processes all the information bits and comes up with a better price than any individual possibly could, and therefore you can't beat the market? Therefore, You shouldn't buy low, sell high. You should invest passively. You should just stay always at the same allocation. That's what happened. Now, the error, and I did an entire podcast on this. It was called the Candyland Hypothesis. Why short-term timing doesn't work. The error was, the phenomenon is true. If you try to pick a good price and you check 6 months later, your results will be no better than a monkey throwing darts at a dartboard. That's true. At least it appears to me it's true. And the hypothesis makes sense. The hypothesis, I guess, would explain it if the market's efficient. But it's not the only hypothesis. They jumped to a conclusion. They said, this efficient market thing would explain it. And then they just said, yeah, that's great. Let's all go with that. And they left out the part about maybe. You know, they just became too full of themselves, too confident, too arrogant. There's an alternate explanation. The alternate explanation is, maybe the market is just bonkers. Maybe the market is just emotion in the short term. If that were true, you wouldn't be able to pick good or bad prices. You might be smart, and the price really is bad, and you know it, but it doesn't do you any good because the market's so bonkers, it goes from bad to worse. And in 6 months, you don't get any benefit. But if that's the explanation, and that's the rational model that we talk about at PassionSaving.com, if that's the explanation, then it's true. You can't buy low, sell high in the short term. You can't pick a price and then get a benefit in 6 months. But you can short long-term time. You can pick a price and expect to see benefits from that in 5 years or 10 years and be ahead of the people investing passively, far, far, far ahead. Less risk, more return. That's the premise of the rational model. So the second stage here was the discovery of the efficient market. And, you know, it started out innocently enough. Reasonable, you know, smart people, reasonable idea. But they jumped to a conclusion. The smart people made a mistake. Now, this is then, of course, everything's fine now, but now we start to get into trouble. This generates a lot of interest. It leads to a wonderful book called A Random Walk Down Wall Street, one of the classic texts in the field of investing by Burton Malkiel. And he argues that the market's efficient. And that book popularized this idea. The academics got all excited all through the 60s. Burton Malkiel took what the academics had done and said, you know, here's the story, people. Put out a book. And the general public read it. And now, you know, passive investing is off to the races. You know, I don't know how many copies it sold. Millions, I imagine. Now, and all he was popularizing this efficient market theory, which is wrong. I say it's a great book because it's so influential. And it's a building block. Without that book, I don't think we could construct the rational model. So a lot of the ideas there are very important. But this core idea, this passive idea, is poison. It's caused the economic crisis. It's caused the greatest loss of middle-class wealth in the history of the United States. It's caused a lot of anger, too, and friction on discussion boards. So that's 1974. Not long after that, I believe it was 1978, John Bogle founds the Vanguard Group of funds. Starts the indexing revolution. Indexing is significant in all kinds of ways. One thing about it is indexes really permit the middle class investor to get involved in stocks in a way they couldn't before because indexes are so simple. And of course, there were things going on in the general society at this time that pushed middle-class investors to get into stocks. Employers were cutting out their pension plans and saying, you know, use this 401k. You fund your retirement. So middle-class people are saying, hey, I've got to do some investing. And it all seems complicated and scary, but this index fund seems pretty simple. So This was a revolution in middle class investing, the indexing revolution. Now, one of the things that happens when you and John Bogle had critics, you know, just as Rob Bennett has critics today. John Bogle took a lot of flack. New ideas are not always greeted with open arms by institutional interest. You see, what happened with the founding of Vanguard is the stock selling industry is, you know, a mammoth industry, and it dominates everything that's said in the investing field because they got hundreds of millions of dollars to devote to whatever they. Who's going to stand up to the stock selling industry? Well, they had a way, you know, every business has a, you know, monetization scheme. You know, some way they're going to make money, some strategy. Well, the stock selling industry had a strategy. I can't go into all the details, but basically the idea was, you know, you get a relationship with the investor through the broker, and the broker recommends some, you know, hot stocks. And you know, it was all BS. I mean, it wasn't all BS. I mean, actually, I think brokers did some good things. But yeah, people always characterize things in extremes. They either say it's wonderful or else they say it's awful. The reality is a lot of things served a purpose, but they were flawed. And I think that was true of the whole way the industry was set up. It was set up that way for a reason, because people were scared about stocks. That's why I think we had brokers. Many people still have brokers, of course, today. But the concept was the broker is a go-between. The broker is a human, and the broker makes you feel comfortable. The broker wins your friendship, and then the broker makes recommendations, and you feel comfortable. And that was needed because of the fear. But with this academic research that was being developed, you know, FAMA started it, but there were obviously thousands of people involved. The industry was saying, our model is dated. We need a new model. And Bogle just sort of bust through the doors. And this is why he had so much flack. There's a famous ad where, you know, Fidelity took out an ad saying that indexing is un-American. I mean, you look back at this stuff and it seems idiotic. But of course, at the time, it didn't seem idiotic. Just as I think it's idiotic today that we can't report the safe withdrawal rate accurately. I think that's 100% idiotic. And I hope someday somebody will, you know, 30 years from now, people will look back and say, can you believe there was a time when you could get banned from a discussion board for reporting the safe withdrawal rate accurately? Is that bizarre? But it upsets people because Bogle upset people because he was upsetting the apple cart. They had a standard way of selling stocks, and Bogle was saying it's going to be different. You know, we're going to cut out a lot of the cost. We're not going to have these brokers. We're just going to buy into index funds. And he was saying it was better. He was saying people would get better returns. In other words, he would look at the Dyna. Look at how compelling a value proposition. He says you don't need the middleman. You don't need the broker because you're buying all the stocks. You're just counting on the U.S. economy and, you know, growing. So cut out all these costs, and you'll be a lot better off. And boy, there's a lot of truth to that. So it was a dynamic new model. You know, Bogle just changed things in about 10 different directions. That's why, you know, people call him St. Jack. I don't call him St. Jack. I think he's a great guy, but I think he made some big mistakes. But I think he did some great things. Okay. So that's the indexing revolution. Essentially what was going on, all sorts of things were going on at one time. But the big thing that was going on is that we were moving from a model where we sold individual stocks to people through brokers to a model where the middle class investor bought indexes and didn't worry about what stock they were buying. They didn't have to research the stock, and they didn't have to research the price. They just bought, you know, like clockwork. You get your paycheck, you put some money in, and they call this passive investing. And a lot of it is based on real research. A lot of it is based on common sense. A lot of it is good. But the passive part is a disaster. But the passive part, notice, the reason that got pulled in is because Bogle was basing everything on this new world where stock investing wasn't, hey, I heard a hot tip. Stock investing became What's the academic research say? And the academic research was based on this efficient market theory. The academic research said there's no way to know if the price is good or not. And again, I have to repeat this because I don't want you to forget. Why did they think there was no way to know? Because the studies they did only looked at short-term timing. The studies only looked at what happens in 6 months, not what happens in 5 years or 10 years. So the studies, you know, they were accurate. They told you accurately what happens in 6 months. Short-term timing doesn't work, and that's an important insight. But they were 100% wrong about long-term timing. Long-term timing always works. It always has. And now we were telling these middle-class people, don't time the market. Don't look at price. We were telling the opposite. That the most important thing in investing is to always take price into account, just as is true in anything you buy. And we were telling them the opposite. We were saying, don't do that. Don't do the most important thing. Just ignore price, the most reckless thing you can do. All right, so now we're in a situation where we have this new model, which is a good model, and we have academic research, which is a good thing. Academic research gives us something objective to go by instead of just going by subjective opinion, which is mostly what we had in the pre-60s chapter, the first chapter of our story. Now we're going by academic research, which gives us something objective to work on, which is wonderful. This is what excites me about all the elements of the passive investing package, except for the passive part, that it's objective information, at least in theory. If you spin it, of course, it becomes subjective, and that's what's happened in the passive investing era. We have all this data, which is great, because it cuts through all the gibberish, cuts through all the subjective opinions, which will drive you out of your mind because you'll have experts on this way and experts that way and you never know what to make of it. It cuts through all that baloney because it's objective. It's based on data. But when you get to a point where you spin the data, you're back to subjectivity. And it's the most dangerous kind of subjectivity you can have because it pretends to be objective. It's a deception. Not deliberate, but it's a deception. Once you take data and you start spinning it, all the benefits of objectivity are out the window. It becomes subjective, but not just subjective. It's authoritative subjectivity. Subjectivity that pretends to be rooted in data. It's the worst kind of subjectivity. That's what passive investing has become. But it certainly had a lot of promise at the time it started. So now we're up to 1978. Now, here's something to keep in mind. Did people know that there was a contradiction? In other words, they're telling people you don't need to look at price. Doesn't that seem insane, as I say it is? Well, yes. I think people always knew there was something wrong. But there was a phrase that John D. Craig had at Vanguard Diehards. He said, there are certain little white lies that have been told. Well, I think that's how people justified it. People looked at this new model and they said, something isn't right here. It's telling us price doesn't matter. Something's wrong. But they said, look, what's the harm? We've got this great new model. We're going to cut costs. They're not going to have to go through brokers. They're going to have index funds. They won't have to research the stocks. This will make middle-class investors, comfortable with buying stocks. We're using academic research, all this stuff. It's market-based. It all makes sense. It's all good. It's all good. Now, if there's some little problem, look, don't worry about it. We have to move forward. You can't get every little thing. And it was sort of true because at 1978, the P/10 level was 8 or 9. It was some very low number. So there really wasn't a risk in passive investing at that time. You could pick your stock allocation and not look at the price of stocks and do just fine because the price of stocks was so low, it was half of fair value, that whatever stock allocation you went with was a good allocation. You almost couldn't overinvest in stocks. So there was, in practical terms, there really was no danger to ignoring price from 1978 all the way up to 1996. That was true. So I think this made people go to sleep. This made people's consciences go to sleep. People said, oh, it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. But I think it was always there. The errors in passive investing are so obvious that they, I don't think it's possible that smart people didn't see them. I don't think it's possible. But the fact that the errors are so obvious came back to bite us. It came back to be a big problem because in later years, when the research showed that passive investing is nonsense, that the efficient market theory is nonsense, one of the things that I think, excuse me, I have something in my throat today. I apologize. One of the things that made it so hard for people to acknowledge the mistake is that the mistake is so painfully obvious. If only this mistake were a complicated mistake, I think that people would have owned up to it right away. They'd say, oh, that I see. We thought the market, we thought passive investing could work, but look at this. Now I understand. But what happened is, I think everybody sort of went along with an idea that didn't really make sense, but it was the best they had, and they just said, let's go with it. And they hushed up. They hushed up their doubts. But then when the reality started to reveal themselves, they said, I can't acknowledge today because now I look like a moron. The flaws in this are so obvious. Yeah, you gotta look at price. Duh. You know, duh. You gotta change your allocation when prices go to insane levels. Duh. They couldn't admit it. And they can't admit it to this day. Jonathan Clements, you know, write his column. I don't apologize. He can't acknowledge that his advocacy of passive investing has caused great human misery because the mistake is so dumb. Of course, it wasn't just Jonathan. It was thousands and thousands of smart people, smart and good people. All right, so that's the 1970s. Now, a very important thing happens in 1981. Robert Shiller comes out with research showing that valuations affect long-term returns. And if valuations affect long-term returns, it's hardly a surprise. Shiller, of course, looked not at short-term timing, he looked at long-term timing. What happens not in 6 months, what happens in, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, whatever. And what the data says is that long-term timing always works. Therefore, passive investing is crazy, can never work. People ignore this for the most part. So I'm sure it caused a stir, caused some controversy in the academic community. I'm sure Shiller got a lot of flack because people had already started doing research under the passive investing model. They didn't want to have to go back and redo it. So it caused flack. In terms of the general public, it was pretty much ignored. It wasn't largely written up in the big things, the Money Magazine or Wall Street Journal or whatever. There was no internet. So he does this research, and now people really have doubts in their minds. They had doubts all along because it didn't make sense. It defied common sense, but now they've got research. So what happens? Do humans respond when the doubts grow bigger? Do humans respond by saying, wait a minute, slow down the train. We got to go back to the drawing board. We made some mistakes. No. What they do is they suppress even more. They always had to suppress. They had to say, oh, little white lies, no big deal. Now, the suppression has to be magnified because now it's not just a question of common sense saying this can't work. Historical data says it can't work. Academic research says it can't work. So the suppression of the realities of investing gets tighter in the early 1980s. Now, things go on. Now, what happens in the 80s? Well, in the 80s, we have a bull market. We have a bull market in the early 90s, a big bull market. How does that affect our history? Well, the way it affects our history is to the general public and to the stock selling industry, because the stock selling industry is focused on marketing. The stock selling industry is using this academic research to sell. They're not the stock selling industry isn't academics. Stock selling industry is about selling a product. They are using research to sell it, But their primary focus, as is true of any industry, is to sell product. So how they interpret the 80s and early 90s is, hey, our marketing campaign has just been vindicated. You know, we've been telling people, buy stocks, ignore price, it's all good. And look what's happening, they're making money, they're happy with us, they're writing us letters telling us, you know, we're heroes. And the public is doing the same thing. The people buying stocks are saying, yeah, you know what, I heard about this passive investing stuff, and I bought some stocks, and now it's 5 years later, and look, I've got 20% a year, I'm getting rich, it's unbelievable. You got to find out about this passive investing stuff. They're telling their friends and their neighbors and their coworkers. And it's spreading and spreading and spreading. And none of this has anything to do with passive investing. All these gains are just normal stock market gains that were going, because the market had been valued at half a fair value. Back when Bogle started Vanguard, stocks were, look at the stock return predictor. The most likely long-term return was about 15% real per year. Stocks were primed when the indexing revolution began to make gigantic gains for many years to come. They were in the best position they could have been, by pure coincidence, I believe. But they were in a great position. But, you know, try telling that to the middle-class investor who followed this and got rich quick. They're all saying, this is fantastic. This is money. This is like a printing press, this passive investing stuff. So now you've got millions and millions and millions of confirmed believers, advocates, and they're spreading the word everywhere. This isn't, you know, these aren't salesmen. They're salesmen, but they're not in the pay. They're not paid by the stock selling industry. They're just your neighbors. They're just ordinary people, and they're telling you this stuff works. And you're no expert. You know, you don't study stocks. Most of us don't. So you buy it. And it spreads and spreads and spreads. The most effective marketing campaign in the history of the world, probably. Because it wasn't being done by salesmen. It was being done by ordinary people who just didn't understand stock investing. There's no reason why they should. Who followed the recommendations of the stock selling industry and got rich. As will happen when the P10 level is 8. It wasn't passive investing that got them rich. It was just the fact that stocks were undervalued, which any rational investor could have told you that stocks were going to do great. But passive investing got the credit because passive investing was the thing that had changed. Passive investing was the thing that was being promoted. Another part of the history, the industry starts devoting hundreds of millions of dollars to promoting this. Well, it's quite natural that an industry would promote an idea, especially when they're changing the whole model of how they sell stocks. And I don't think the people in the industry deliberately, you know, tried to rape the middle class investor. I think they believe this stuff. I think a lot of people believe it today. Millions believe it today. But I don't think they were ignorant of the fact that this really sold, that this package of marketing slogans was powerful. And the power in it was it sounded prudent. The middle class investor is a prudent person. You know, in general, we all have a get-rich-quick impulse within us. But the middle-class investor tries to resist that. And this was a model on how to invest that said, this isn't about stock tips. This is prudent. This is oh, it's not exciting for cocktail parties, you know. It's sort of like reverse marketing. They're saying, all the rest is financial porn. We're different. And it sounds true. It sounds like they really are different. Because they're saying you don't have to pick hot stocks. You just put your money in. You leave it there. It sounds like it's long-term. It sounds like it's safe. It sounds like it's prudent. It's got academic research. It hit all the right emotional buttons, which all effective marketing must. So you've got this you know, big marketing campaign. You've got academic research, which is a big selling point. And on top of all that, you've got success in the real world. This is bringing in, making people rich. And you've got unpaid salesmen promoting it all throughout the country. All right. You know, it's out of control. And then another chapter in the history was the issuance of the book Stocks for the Long Run, which sort of summed it all up. Summed it all up and put it on paper. That was 1994. That's probably the high point of passive investing, the issuance of stocks for the long run. Huge bull market, everything was groovy. passive investing had conquered the world. Now, meanwhile, in the background, people are checking Shiller's research, expanding it, and it's checking out every which way it can be checked. The theory is more, you know, 1,000 times more popular, just getting more and more popular by the day. But the academic research is showing stronger and stronger that the theory can never work in the real world. Got a conflict. 1996, Shiller testifies to the Federal Reserve, and he uses the phrase irrational exuberance. He says, we've got a problem here. We've got a public policy problem. We're going to destroy this economy if we keep promoting this stuff, if we don't tell people, if we don't do something about this out-of-control bubble. He said, in the next 10 people, in the people investing heavily in stocks today are going to live to regret it within the next 10 years. And Greenspan looked at it. Greenspan took it somewhat seriously. And then he ultimately decided, no, I can't take this on, for whatever reasons. He's admitted he made a mistake in the time since. So the warnings are delivered, and the warnings are ignored. But you have to look at the incentives. No one had an incentive to step in. The politicians didn't want to step in. You know, Clinton could have stepped in. Greenspan could have stepped in. They would have been hung. The public loved this passive investing stuff. The stock selling industry could have stepped in. They could have said, oh, sorry, everybody, we actually made a mistake. We didn't mean any of that stuff. Well, they're making millions. You had a whole new industry being formed. You know, financial consultants and all this thing, financial planning industry. And the whole credibility of this industry depends on the fact that there's academic research. You admit that all the academic research is bogus. Not, you know, not bogus in the sense that it was faked, but bogus in the sense that it's wrong. And you blow that whole thing up. Why blow it up when you've got millions coming in? If it's not broke, don't fix it. It's broke underneath. Shiller's telling us we're going to have an economic collapse, but it's not broke on the surface. As far as the headlines go, it's a raving success. Then we have the tech crash. That shook some people up. But did that shake up the passive investors? Not really. The thing about humans is, when you believe in something, when you have an emotional investment in something, you can convert any fact to support the emotion. The tech crash was a warning, if ever there was one. The NASDAQ was not an efficient market. What did it go from 5,000 to, like, you know, 1,000? If that doesn't tell you that there's a problem, what would? The you know, if the market, if the Dow and the S&P are efficient, the NASDAQ should be efficient. But some of those stocks lost 98% of their value or more. So what did the passive investors do? They said, oh, this proves the beauty of passive investing. Those stupid people who invested in the NASDAQ, they weren't passive investors. Passive investing is investing in a broad index. It's okay to have a little bit of tech, but you need to be in the S&P or the total stock market index, not, or the Dow, but no, not those people were stupid, non-passive. You see, they turned hostility. Instead of learning from the experience, they turned hostility. They called these people stupid and irresponsible and reckless. They were doing the same thing as they were. The tech people were a little worse than the people investing in the big indexes, but not that much. The NASDAQ was more overvalued than the S&P was, but not by that much. Because the tech stocks were more overvalued, they crashed first. It's overvaluation that causes crashes. So they crashed first, and they crashed, you know, worse in percentage terms. But the S&P and the Dow were every bit as much primed for a crash. Crash was every bit as inevitable. So then we had a slow leak crash from 2000 to 2008. From 2000, now you can go back to 94 and say certificates of deposit have beat stocks. But from 2000 to 2008, stocks performed poorly. Stocks were barely holding water. They weren't losing, but you weren't making any gains. You would have been better off in TIPS or I-bonds during that time period. Then we had the great safe withdrawal rate debate. You know, that I don't know how that's going to be treated in the history books, but that started May 13th, 2002. This is what persuaded me of the craziness. Rob Bennett went to a discussion board, reported the safe. I noticed that Bill Bernstein said that valuations affect long-term returns as a matter of mathematical certainty. So I said, well, if that's true, all these safe withdrawal rate studies got the numbers wrong. All the retirement studies are wrong. Why don't we calculate them properly? And set off, you know, the most controversial series of investing discussions in the history of the internet by asking that a number be calculated properly. Well, that doesn't tell you there's a problem. Again, I don't know what would. But the passive investors shrug it off. They just say, there's a guy reporting the safe withdrawal rate accurately. That makes us, if the safe withdrawal rate has been reported wrong all these years, then passive investing is nonsense. Because any model that causes the retirement numbers to be wildly wrong is a model that obviously doesn't work. So what should we do? Well, one thing to do would be replace the model. But you don't want to do that because you're emotionally invested in it. So the alternative is ban the guy reporting the numbers accurately. So that's the great safe withdrawal rate debate. Continues to this day at the Retire Early and Indexing discussion boards and you know, in the personal finance blogosphere as well in recent months. So finally, we get to the passive investing stock crash of September 2008. You know, a very significant event, the total failure of passive investing. As I say, certificates of deposit are now ahead of stocks going back, you know, 15, 16 years. Forget about TIPS and I-bonds, which were far higher than certificates of deposit. You know, when they say certificates of deposit are ahead of stocks, they're talking about 6-month certificates of deposit. They weren't paying 4% real, 6-month certificates of deposit. You could have had TIPS paying 4% real. They would have been beating stocks going farther back than 94. A lot farther back. So the safe investment classes are ahead of stocks, you know, close to 20 years now, if you measure it in a fair way. That got people thinking. And, you know, the wonderful thing is that since the crash, there have been dozens, scores of articles saying the efficient market theory is flawed and needs to be replaced. There's been this book come out, The Myth of Rational Markets. So people are starting to post honestly. People are starting. But the piece we're missing is we have to stop promoting, you know, the logical conclusion. If the efficient market theory is wrong, there's no reason to invest passively. We need to stop promoting passive investing. We need to allow a national debate on what really works. Such a national debate will lead to the further development of the rational investing model. That's what we need to save, you know, pull the economy out of this crisis, to restore faith in the stock market, in our economic system, and even in our political system, which the general public blames for this. And I don't think improperly so. The political system had a role. Greenspan should have stepped in. Clinton should have stepped in. Bush should have stepped in. Obama should have stepped in. The people who are in charge should have done something. They have advisors. They have advisors, economic advisors, who are familiar with the literature and know that Shiller's been saying for 28 years that valuations affect long-term returns. So the public is properly blaming the political system for this failure. But we have not yet reached a point. I feel it was a significant day when Jonathan Clements wrote that article saying, I won't apologize, or I don't apologize. I don't recall what the title was exactly. I don't apologize, I think it was. Because he was speaking for all passive investing advocates. None of them are yet willing to come out and say in clear and unmistakable terms, I was wrong, or at the very least, I'm not sure. If they say I'm not sure, we move to the next stage. Now, I'm just going to talk briefly about what's to come in you know, the opinion of old Farmer Hocus. The next big development, I expect, is going to be another big stock crash. Can't say when. Short-term timing doesn't work, so I don't know. But I would guess in the next year or two or three. The biggest reason why I think there's going to be another stock crash is we've gone to insane valuation levels 4 times in U.S. history. The first 3 times we fell afterwards to a P10 level of 7 or 8. This time we're at 16. So we'd have to fall 50% to get back to where we've always fallen before. The reason why we fall so low, 16 is fair value. So in economic terms, there's no need for a fall whatsoever. But stock investing is primarily an emotional endeavor. And we were delivered a huge emotional hit when our retirement accounts were wiped out. And we haven't accepted that. If we had accepted it, there would be no more advocacy of passive investing today. We still have bans on honest posting, in effect, on the internet. So we haven't yet accepted that passive investing has failed. That means we haven't accepted the realities. We're still engaging in, cognitive dissonance. Which means there's all kinds of bad stuff that is working its way into our mind and into our heart. And as that stuff works its way into our mind, confidence is going to drop even more. There are people today who still believe they're going to get their money back. It's been almost a year since the crash, not quite. But there are still people thinking they're going to get some of that money back. And as long as those hopes are there, we're not going to have the second part of this big crash. But once those hopes evaporate, and eventually they will, then you will have the next stage of the big crash. Now, that's a very scary development. Another 50% loss, and it's possible that, you know, we go into a depression, and it's possible it's game over. So that's very, very dark. However, there's a bright side to it. Once we let in how disastrous this promotion of passive investing has been, I think we will have a break in the psychology. We will get to a point where people will just throw up their hands and say, you know what? I don't care anymore about saying I'm wrong. I want to get some retirement money back. I'm willing to look at realistic strategies. And when that happens, we're off to the races because we have 28 years of research to benefit from. Schiller and lots of other people who have been doing good research for decades now. We haven't been able to talk about it. Schiller himself said he couldn't tell us all he knew about investing because if he did, he would be labeled unprofessional in the passive investing era. And it wasn't just Rob Bennett who couldn't report accurately what the safe withdrawal rate said. No one, even a tenured professor at Yale, a best-selling author, didn't feel comfortable telling the truth about stock investing. No one did. The price for telling the truth about stock investing in the passive investing era was horrendous. Ask me sometime and I'll show you the scars. That's a quote from a Dylan song. It was horrendous. And so what we've done is we've locked away. You know, what you need when you've made a mistake is information to fix it. All learning experiences come through admitting mistakes. And we can't admit it today. But we're getting there. We're circling around. We're sort of toying with the idea of allowing honest posting. We're playing with it. We're putting out books called The Myth of Rational Markets, you know, putting out these articles saying the efficient market theory is nonsense. We're getting there, but we're not yet putting all the pieces together. When we put all the pieces together, we're going to have a big punch to the stomach. We're probably going to see another stock crash. I'm not certain, but I think probably a 70% chance. And then if we survive, if we pull together, if we turn to hate, I think we go over the cliff. But if we turn to love and we say, you know, I have a podcast where I say the good populism, the bad populism. We need populism because the experts let us down. You know, the experts don't want to acknowledge this. So we need ground roots demands for realistic investing information. But we don't want to tear down institutions because we need these institutions. We need these experts. We need all these people. The people who built the passive investing model are some of the smartest people out there. And they've laid the groundwork for the most wonderful investing strategy of all time, rational investing, which has all the elements of passive except for the passive part. It has low cost. It has ignored the short-term noise. It has focus on the long-term. It has stick with the strategy. It has index instead of picking stocks. All these things. And the people who develop that stuff need to be part of the project, in my opinion. So that's the next stage, the crash and then the decision. Which way do we go? And, you know, I'm not even going to talk about the possibility that we go over the cliff, because then there's nothing to talk about. Forget about financial freedom. It's not going to happen. But if we decide to work together, if we choose the path of love, the golden age of middle class investing is the next stop on this tour. If we go down to a P10 level of 7 or 8, you have 10 years where the expected return is 14% real per year. Take steps today to save some of your money for that time period, if it's coming, which it may, I think the odds certainly are. So that's our little history of little history of investing, according to Old Farmer Holkus. We made a mistake. We jumped to a hasty conclusion. We did some wonderful things, making investing more objective and coming up with a new model where the middle class invests through indexes rather than by picking individual stocks. We've got the pieces in place for the golden age of middle class investing, but we've got to somehow work up the courage to go back and acknowledge the mistake. The mistake was this idea that all forms of timing don't work. The reality is short-term timing doesn't work, and that's a huge insight. But long-term timing always works, and long-term timing is 100% required for anyone hoping to have a realistic chance of long-term success as an investor. So the future of investing, and I have a series of 4 podcasts on the future of investing, but in brief, the future of investing is exploring how to engage in long-term timing. That's what it's all about. Successful investors are investors who engage in long-term timing, and we need to have everybody contributing to that debate, a national debate on how to invest, starting at the beginning. We got to wipe the slate clean, forget everything we quote-unquote learned during the passive investing era, and take the good out of that era and leave the bad stuff behind, and work together to learn not just that, of course, long-term timing works. That should be obvious. It's common sense. In the passive investing era, we couldn't talk about common sense. That was forbidden. That was taboo. Now we need to open up our discussions of investing to common sense considerations. We need to discuss investing in a realistic, prudent, rational, serious way. And, you know, the history is, it's rocky. There's never been a time in any field in which history is all forward. But we have a lot of forward motion here. We made one big mistake, which has crushed us, brought our economy to its knees. Let's try to overcome that mistake. Let's show some love and courage and move to the next stage, the golden age of middle class investing, the rational investing era. Good luck with your investing strategies.